And this is the Dead TV Podcast, a podcast dedicated to canceled television shows in the horror, science fiction, fantasy genre, where we go over them episode by episode. And the series we are currently on is Constantine, and I am your host, Dr. Chris.
And I'm Mr. Seneca.
And tonight's episode of Constantine, episode 4 of the one and only season, is...
A Feast of Friends. When an old friend accidentally releases a powerful demon in Atlanta, John must determine what he is willing to sacrifice in his battle with the underworld.
Dun dun. Dun dun dun. And this episode is probably one of the more disturbing episodes of Constantine, in my opinion, just based on the eating problems throughout the episode.
You know, I actually really, really, really enjoyed this show. This is based on the Hellblazer comic. This is a story arc ripped straight from the pages.
Oh.
And so this is in the original sense. If you've got the trade paperback or you want to pick up the issue, it is actually Hellblazer number 1 and number 2.
Yes.
So it's ripped straight from the comics, and what they changed, I was okay with. How they interpreted the story for television overall, I was perfectly fine with, but I know we're going to go into all those details during this conversation.
The episode opens up with our new character arriving at the airport.
Gary Lester.
Yes. Where the TSA is giving him a hard time, and I'm wondering, since you travel a little bit more than I do for work, does the TSA ever give you this much of a hard time? Do you ever travel with anything that might be considered in your other lifestyle, Mistress Zeneca?
Well, you know, the old saying, like, you always take your batteries out of your vibrators when you go through TSA.
Oh.
Because they will always harass you. I personally haven't had a lot of harassment by the TSA, unless I was wearing a corset, because of the metal boning always sets off the alarms. And if I'm doing that, I always try to make some, you know, time accommodations for that, you know. The amount of harassment that you're going to get out of the TSA. Gary, on the other hand, he's sweating profusely and he looks guilty. He should have probably just said, I'm a heroin addict. I haven't had a fix in 3 days. Let me out of here. And maybe they would have actually let him go. But, yeah, he's looking really, really shifty. And, you know, he gets sent back to the interrogation room where this lovely southern cop is interrogating him. And the bottle that is on the table, which he says is like this priceless artifact. Usually if you're traveling with something of that caliber of value, they usually won't give you a hard time about it, especially if it comes back free of all the tests. Like if they test it for drugs and test it for explosives and it's fine, then you really shouldn't be harassed with something like that. Because art travels across the world all the time. So I think there was a little bit of stepping over the line with the cop, you know, but according to the comic, the bottle itself has a bit of power to talk to people around it in order to try to convince them to release it, kind of like a genie in a bottle type of thing.
Yeah, he basically doesn't want him to open it up, and the TSA agent is completely dismissive of his warning. And then we have our song, and we cut to John and Zeb in the park having what looks to be like a trying to have a normal day before good old Manny shows up. I said Zeb, I meant Zed. Manny shows up to freeze time to warn John of the pending doom, which we will get to in an upcoming episode.
And just like in the previous episode, Manny's appearance in this one does nothing to further the plot. He's in there. Zed gets these visions of like pennies from heaven, and he appears and just says, "Hey, you know, there's still this danger out there," and that's it. Yeah, he just poofs, disappears.
You know what's kind of funny? I was thinking about something that occurs on another DC show, but never actually happened on Constantine. Now, again, it's been a couple of years since I've watched every episode, and I'm only watching them as we do this podcast. But there's a character that appeared around the same time on another show when this episode was airing. The character who would eventually become Solomon Grundy was on Arrow.
Oh, really?
Yes, his human form was on Arrow, and the episode ends looking at his tombstone saying born on a Monday.
Like the poem.
And I was hoping Cyrus Gold, that's the character's real name. That's Solomon Grundy's real name. I was hoping that he would maybe appear on Constantine if Constantine were to continue.
Yeah, I mean, this is such a good show, and every episode, they seem to be doing a lot of homework, and that, you know, like in the last one, The Devil's Vinyl, I really appreciate the amount of thought that goes into all of the occult and magical items that he encounters, and the storylines get intertwined with the theology. I'm really appreciating it. And this episode, like, I've got a lot to talk about Solomon, because it is a constant throughout this entire episode.
Oh, so I have to correct myself. Yes. Cyrus Gold did appear on Arrow, but it doesn't say born on a Monday. At the end of the episode, Oliver says died on a because he was killed at the end of the episode on a Saturday, and they buried him on Sunday. Which is part of the poem of Solomon Grundy. And Solomon Grundy, actually the creature Solomon Grundy, will appear in the season finale of Gotham this year.
And you know what the funny thing about Solomon Grundy is, that when you're trying to find plant villains, mm-hmm. you know, villains that have control over plants, you know, you always think of, like, Poison Ivy. But the way Poison Ivy thinks about her plants is like they're her babies, they're her children. Solomon Grundy is really the only other villain that has, like, plant control powers of some sort, where he doesn't care about the plants to the point of that, you know, type of affinity like Poison Ivy. It's really weird, because, like, you know, we were talking earlier about I did this the Villains Ball last November. And I had a feast of fiends, you know, like this episode is a feast of friends. So I had a feast of fiends, and I needed a villain to go along with each course of dinner. And Solomon Grundy was the only villain I could find to sponsor, basically, a salad course. Because, you know, villains are pretty much carnivores. But that was the only villain I could find. It's kind of interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. Solomon Grundy showed up in the John Constantine Justice League episode that was Justice League Action, which is the 15-minute short cartoons that you can find online on iTunes, I think. But Bruce Timm, creator of Harley Quinn and Batman the Animated Series, came on my show. He said that you can find him on iTunes and on Comcast or your on demand. Solomon Grundy is the main villain in that, with John Constantine and Swamp Thing and Zatanna and Batman.
A great lineup. Great lineup.
Yes, yes. The episode more focuses on Batman teaming up with Swamp Thing to fight Solomon Grundy, but John Constantine does get his own episode later on in the first season of Justice League Action. But back to this show.
Yes. back to Constantine.
I love the line that John uses, dank bag music.
Yeah. There's a lot of little tiny colloquialisms in this episode that really brought out the charm, I think.
Hmm.
And did you notice that Chaz was not in this episode? He's quote-unquote fixing the cab, you know, since he crashed it at the end of the last episode.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't think that was really necessary to say that the reason why he was gone, but hey, they did it. You know, and just on a personal note, this whole episode kind of freaked me out. I don't like cockroaches at all. Like, phobia, like, don't like cockroaches. And These are not cockroaches. These are the Capra beetles, otherwise known as the cabinet beetle. But they appear and they move like cockroaches. You know, whenever the demon kind of enters and exits a body, it's the swarm of Capra beetles. And Capra beetles are only about like 3 millimeters long. They're very, very tiny. But these are fucking huge. They're like 3 inches big. And yeah, just kind of skeeved me out.
Yeah, no, I can't do bugs. I don't think it has anything to do with anything in real life, but it's mostly like movie stuff. I always remember as a child watching the very famous and one of the greatest action sagas of all time, Indiana Jones, and the Indiana Jones middle film, The Temple of Doom, when yeah. Willy has to stick her hand into the bug thing.
Yeah.
Oh my god! Oh, by the way, this week's episode of my other podcast, Supernatural Creatures and Lore, is entitled Bugs, and we discover that my young co-host, Kat, is afraid of bugs as much as she is of clowns.
Yeah. You know, like, for me, not all bugs do it. It's just cockroaches.
Mr. Zetica could take
a... barely resembles cockroaches.
Mr. Zetica's into all sorts of weird and unusual things, which you can listen to other episodes to learn about. But bugs is where she draws the line.
Yes. That is definitely the line there.
Yeah.
I have threatened to move from places for cockroaches. Like, I don't tolerate that shit.
So John goes out to investigate more of this, and he leaves our buddy Gary there with Zed. And I love John says when he goes out to investigate and finds out that it's a hunger demon, he says the line, "Are you taking the piss?"
Oh. Yeah. Another one of those English colloquialisms.
Yeah, taking the piss is a Commonwealth term meaning to take liberties at the expense of others or to be unreasonable. It is often used to mean or confuse with taking the piss out of, which is an expression meaning to mock, tease, ridicule, or scoff. Zed takes a junkie trip with Gary, which I thought was... she does it twice. And
yeah,
I thought
yeah.
that
she gets basically the raw end of the junkie stick when she touches him, or they accidentally touch, or he touches her, you know. And she gets this. It was mentioned earlier that she has never done drugs because
correct.
She has this psychic power and she doesn't need it enhanced. And getting all of the effects of his withdrawal symptoms all at once, it really like almost it looks like it traumatizes her. Yeah, you know, that'd be a pretty frightening experience if you've never had that. And you know, Gary differs from the comic book version of Gary Lester, because in the comic book version, the first time you see him, he is sitting in John's apartment in the bathtub with bugs crawling all over him.
Yeah.
Kind of uncontrollably crawling all over him. It's freaky.
I just,
and in
that
this episode
image,
when he's introduced, he's or when John you know, sees him for the first time, he is floating in a zero gravity trap that's in the vault. And Gary in the comic book is actually a much more pathetic character. Like, he is very kind of weaselly, pathetic. You don't really feel all that much for him. You just the sense of like, ugh, you're a junkie. You know, he's shooting up like vials with bugs in them. You know, like, it's really like gross and disgusting.
Yeah.
The way they portrayed him in this show is that they gave him a bit more of that empathy. They wanted the audience to empathize with Gary's struggle. So whenever Zed and he touch, she feels that pain and that sorrow and that loss of his life and his whole existence. And that also makes you empathize with the character a bit more. I enjoyed it.
Now, the actor who played the character Gary is John Joe O'Neill, who has a long career with being a bit part character. He's been in Band of Brothers. He was in the movie He was in the movie Defiance, which I believe is the James Bond actor, Daniel Craig, who they're like the Jews that fight the Nazis in World War II.
Yeah, he's recognizable. You know, I as soon as I saw him, it's one of those faces like I've seen him before, but where have I seen him?
Murphy's Law, Doctor Who, various video games. He was in 7 episodes of The Fall. If you watch that, that was the TV series starring Gillian Anderson.
No, I had not watched that series.
Yeah, it's kind of a murder mystery show where she plays what you basically... She plays like a character on that show you would normally write for a guy. You know, very hard-edged, fucks whoever she can, drinking, hard, you know, down-to-earth cop. Right. Very typical man type of role, usually. Very, 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 very good. Worth checking out. Unfortunately, I damn the show because it's one of the reasons why we've had the 11th season of The X-Files delayed until just recently announced to return.
Cool.
Yes. And the 11th season of The X-Files will have 13 episodes this time, not 6.
Aha, nice.
Yes.
I'm glad it's making a comeback.
Yes, yep. It will finally be making a comeback, and they expect it to be out by late 2018. Still a long ways away, though, but we got the X-Files coming back, so. By the way, speaking of Solomon, there's an actor in this episode. He plays the character Samir. I don't remember which one that was, but there's an actor named Solomon Gibson who's in this episode. He plays
really?
Samir. Yeah, I don't remember which character Samir is.
I don't know. I don't have that character in my notes.
Anyway, okay. Moving on. I love, by the way, John goes to where the most recent outbreak has happened, and he's got a CDC badge that says Lee Dryguess. Does that name ring any bells?
Ooh, no, I didn't catch that one. I just caught that he was using that playing card that I thought that the bum had snuck off with last time.
Oh, his magic papers. If you were,
yeah,
he was the doctor.
His magic playing card that can be anything.
Oh, I was thinking of it more like his magic papers, like the doctor has in Doctor Who.
Oh no, I'm not a Doctor Who watcher.
Ah, oh, shame on you.
Yeah, I it's just part of my geek card. I just never got punched.
By the way, the first issue of Hellblazer, where this whole thing is taking place, referencing the comic book, the artwork is drawn by John Ridgway and written by Jamie Delano,
Delano,
with the painted cover by Dave McKinnon. But John Ridgway's artwork in the 40-page premiere issue, which you can believe, if you can believe that, the first issue of Hellblazer was 40 pages and only cost like $2 or something in 1988. It cost $1.25 for 40 pages in 1988 for Hellblazer number one. But John's artwork brings to life in a very grotesque, unique way at the time. For 1980s comic book, blew everyone away. The scene where the bugs are like crawling in and out of Gary.
Yeah, no, it was designed to hook you, and when I started reading it, I was definitely hooked. You know, the first issue is called Hunger, and then the second issue is the Feast of Friends. But you get that hook into the artwork, just the storyline, the grittiness of it. And, you know, that's probably why they made it 40 pages, because just they want to capture that audience. And I think it was a very successful way to do that.
The I thought that one of the most disturbing moments in the episode, which, by the way, this episode does not get a yum moment from us at all. There's so much grossness going on.
No
yum.
Yum at all.
We take away one of your previous yum awards, John Constantine. I'm sorry. Your douchebag moment is coming up, but don't worry. There is no yum moment for us. But the victims have like a ring face. Do you know what I mean when I say that?
Which one? The original one? The African boy?
Well, the one John,
later in the episode,
the when John's playing the CDC and he pulls the tarp back and sees the victim's face. It's like the ring. It's like the victims of the ring bitch who crawls out of the TV.
Oh yeah, the kind of the sunken, sallow, sucked out life force
Correct.
type of design for that. That's actually in the comic book. I was
Yes.
really impressed by that.
Maybe that's where they got the idea for him in the ring when they created the manga. Who knows? Maybe because the manga did come out in the 90s, well after Hellblazer had been established.
Yeah, I don't really know where they got inspiration for that one, but when you see the first victim eat himself to death, and before in the comic book, before John's really introduced, that sunken, sallow, life sucked out, life energy, just the shell of a person left on the ground after that huge eating binge. Yeah, they did that wonderful in the show. I think that was a very loyal representation.
I love the fact that the place that it's happening, it's a pig and a it's a meat factory, right? They process animals, and there's a pig and a cow dancing, and you're like, who the hell would come up with a symbol for a meat packing plant of a pig and a cow dancing art hand in hand like a couple of lovers, and they're about to be
Yeah,
slaughtered.
that's the Hofreichter meat. When he first gets in there and he sees the dead body on the ground, he's like, "Oh, yeah, I know the demon's here." And right on the wall is a dry erase board. It's like so many days from the last accident, and John erases it and writes zero.
Yes, I thought that was the best thing ever. When he meets the next victim that he has to exorcise, she does like this spider walk, like in The Exorcist,
Yeah,
which Reagan
classic
does.
spider walk.
Yes, can you do the spider walk? Do you are you are you are
Oh,
you nimble
I
enough?
am not that flexible. Like, I'm flexible, but not backwards.
How flexible are you?
I can play octopus if you're familiar with that game.
I'm not.
Octopus is like Twister, but imagine that each limb of your body, including your head, has a colored Velcro strap. And so you spin the spinner like Twister, and then color Velcro strap from one person goes to color Velcro strap from the other, and you guys get kind of twisted into this, like, they call it octopus, so eight arms, until you cannot complete the next spin around, and then it's, your turn is over. So I can do that, but back bends, no.
Oh,
But
okay.
this actress must have been a dancer, because not only does she do the spider walk, but she also does like a severe lean back without support, and that type of move you really can only do if you have that severe core strength. Unless you're wearing like Michael Jackson's moonwalk shoes and you have that peg, hooked into your shoe that you won't actually be knocked over. But she does that, and it's like this very kind of zombie exorcist thing. And I looked at him like, oh yeah, cool. Yeah, cliche, but cool.
Okay, so that started down this path.
So
John visits the
now,
shaman.
well, John tries to capture the demon in the bottle that he had written on with Solomon's ring and has the seal of Solomon on it. In the meatpacking plant, like, he drops the bottle. The demon was just too strong to actually be captured in the bottle. He couldn't physically hold it. Drops it, shatters it, and he ends up like locking the demon inside a freezer for a while. Let's see. But what I wanted to get to is that Solomon comes up a lot in this episode, and when I say that they did their research on Solomon and the actual like storyline in the comic book, the arc is quite simple. It's the demon, which is African origin, gets captured inside a human being in order to basically trap it there. It has the sigils of shielding on it, and then it gets moved to the U.S. In the comic, Gary Lester actually ships it over to Constantine, but it ends up being in the post office as an undelivered package, and then someone from the post office actually opens it up, and he's the first victim. The way that they weaved in Solomon's Tale. If you don't know anything about King Solomon, the Seal of Solomon typically has the same type of Star of David on it. You know, they're kind of both based on the same type of thing. King Solomon was known for being the wisest king or ruler ever. Mm-hmm. Right? He was very, very wealthy. Like, he's the most wealthy person in the entire world at that time. And when Constantine has this Ring of Solomon, the Ring of Solomon has the powers to basically control demons. It can control demons, control genies, can talk to animals, etc. But what they show here is not the Ring of Solomon. The Ring of Solomon that's shown in the Constantine show is kind of covering his index finger and has this bracelet attached to it. Did you notice that it has, like, all sorts of symbols on it and whatnot?
Yep.
The symbols that they used on the bottle, that's legit. That's the Seal of Solomon. The symbols on the bracelet, I couldn't really make out so much, but it seems to correspond with the Seal of Solomon. That's fine. There's tales. There's a Sufi tale about when King Solomon got this ring. And then there is a Testament of Solomon that was written in the 1st century AD that basically tells the story of how Solomon controls demons. Neither of these tales feature a ring that's anything more than a standard size ring. So what they designed for this show is completely unique as for the look of King Solomon's ring. There are conflicting tales as to what it exactly contains and what it's made of. In some tales, it is part brass and part iron. The brass part, if you write with the brass part, it commands the good entities, you know, the good spirits, the good demons, good genies, etc. If you write with the iron part, it commands the bad entities, you know, bad demons and whatnot. So you can write commands in either using the brass part or the iron part, and those entities must obey it because it is the word of God. Now, the Ring of Solomon, all the accounts show that the Ring of Solomon has the true name of God written on it, and it's four letters.
I thought it was Jehovah.
What?
I thought the true name of God was Jehovah.
No, that's not the true name.
Oh.
No one. If you had the true name according to all the lore, if you actually had the true name of God, then you would not be able to use that and just say it.
Gotcha.
Yeah. In the saying of it would be magic. So, but the ring actually had the true name of God, and in so doing, that ring controls anything on earth. So, this ring Archangel Michael gave to King Solomon, and he said, "Wear this ring, and all the demons of the earth, both male and female, thou wilt command." And in some cases, it's told to be a golden ring, with a single green shamir stone that's in the form of an 8-rayed star, and then it has the seal in stone on the ring. So it's gold plus stone. On some accounts, it has four jewels, one jewel from each of the archangels, and those four jewels combined, our powers combined, help him to control the four elements.
Captain Solomon, he's our hero. He's gonna find us the treasure. The most I know about Solomon, when you said King Solomon, the first time I'd ever heard of King Solomon is that movie, The Quest for King Solomon's Mine or something.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's getting back there, man.
Yeah. That's how I roll.
The tales of how this comes about, and this ties into the whole theme of the hunger demon that's actually he's battling in this episode, is that in the tales, like in the Sufi tale of King Solomon, when he acquired the ring, is that there was jewels being stolen from his property, his keep, his vault, and there would be no way that a human could have stolen those gems. He begs and prays to God for a way to control the demon that is taking his wealth. Archangel Michael gives him this ring from the power of God, and then he commands the demon that's there to appear and then reveal his true name, and the demon's name is Ornius. And turns out he is a vampiric demon. And the reason that he said that he was taking the jewels is because he had this deep, unsatisfied hunger. And this hunger controlled him. And so he drinks the light of the gems because the gems were born at the dawn of the creation of the earth. And so he was basically drinking a piece of heaven every time that he drank from the stones and ingested them. So it has that hunger, you know, that deep hunger to this creature. Solomon, actually, in listening to the vampiric demon's tale, takes pity on him because he understands, through the wisdom of Solomon, he understands the loss and the sense of pain that this demon vampire creature has. And then he implants the seal of Solomon onto the demon and thus controls him forevermore.
Now, the name of the demon, the name of the demon, is mentioned by the shaman that John goes to visit. The demon's name is Nimeth.
Yes.
Yes.
Nimoth.
Nimoth. Sorry.
That particular name is just for Constantine. That's the same name that they used in the comic book, but it does not have a, you know, occult reference.
This episode is so out there with its weirdness, but it's right up the alley of the guy who directs it. John Showalter has a long history with directing weird and unusual episodes of television. He's worked on Ghost Whisperer, Criminal Minds, Supernatural, The Mentalist, and is no slouch in the DC department, having directed several episodes of Supergirl, The Flash, and Lois and Clark, The New Adventures of Superman.
I mean, I'm really impressed by that.
Yeah.
This is right in his wheelhouse.
Yeah. And what I'm really looking forward to is in 2 weeks when we return, we're going to talk about the episode I've been waiting for, which is going to have Jim Corrigan in it.
Yes.
The director of that episode directed Saturday Night Fever and War Games.
It's so good, too.
Yeah. So, but we'll get there in 2 weeks. The shaman also happens to mention that particular thing that we brought up in the first episode about John and that little girl.
Astra, yeah.
Yep.
Because Gary Lester is actually from that portion of his life.
Correct.
So he was there at Newcastle when the shit went down. And so that is like haunting Gary and basically went and drove him to become a truly hardcore junkie.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, had his whole life collapse because of that. But that's mentioned a lot in this episode. It's part of the character development for Gary. It is probably part of the character development or relationship building between Zed and John. His ability to trust her has been strengthened through this episode.
Yep.
And that hunger demon in just the overall vibe of the addiction element that Gary has with the heroin, it's all hunger related. It's all like you're trying to fulfill a need, a deep-seated need. And I think that's why Min-Moth was attracted to Gary, and that's why Gary was kind of urged to release Min-Moth from the human shell that he had been trapped in and put into the bottle. Now, in the scene with Gary Lester when he's actually trapping Min-Moth from the little boy. I wouldn't call him a little boy. He's a little boy in the comic book. In the television show, he's actually kind of a teenager. But when he's actually saying, the translation of the Latin that he's actually saying on screen is, "My blood, my heart, my mind, my soul, illuminate with thy spirit. Hear your servant, life force bound to this vessel. I humbly invoke thee to do thy bidding. I breach thee bindings, I command the luminescence lifted and grant this darkness passage. I offer thee freedom and my humble soul as thy vessel." And so that is the reason why Min Moth never enters Gary Lester. He basically just offered him his soul.
I thought maybe he wouldn't want him in there because of just like how screwed up he is.
I don't know if it's like a kinship with the whole hunger thing, whether the addiction is just so strong with Gary that Min Moth empathizes with them, or it just was the avenue that Min Moth took in order to get someone willing to get him out of that trapped body that he was in and give him more ability to reign on Earth. I don't know. There's some tie there. But this whole episode is about addiction, hunger, and the forces and consequences of that.
The spell that's put together involving the eyeballs and the tongue being removed is...
But you had to cut out the tongue because then the demon might speak and curse people or might say something to magically cause himself to be out of the body. I don't know how strong those sigils, those sealing sigils were on the boy. But an unwilling participant, that shaman just takes the boy, puts the demon into him, carves the symbols onto him, and then just kind of leaves him there, and somehow the guy finds Gary Lester. Don't know how. They even talk about how strange of a coincidence that might be.
Gary grabs Zed again and gives her the heroin high, but even worse this time in a way that really affects her just because of how she's acting when John shows back up and Gary is missing. Their connection was so strong that, like, when she touches him, that's the way it is. Can you imagine if she, like, you know, like, made out with him or exchanged fluids with him, geez, in any way? Just, like, how over the top it would kill her because of her being this empath.
Yeah. I might actually be afraid for her just because the emotions involved with sexual contact is so strong, and if you're not on the same page, it can be disastrous.
Yeah, and that's something that, like, I hope they cover because I don't exactly remember if they do. If they cover in the Constantine in the upcoming episodes with Zed, and if she, you know, her sexual prowess with other people and how strong it is for her.
I don't know. I mean,
talk about a mind-numbing orgasm, you know?
Yeah, then blow the top of her head off.
Yeah. Almost like having sex with Superman and just being like a shotgun blast blowing through you out through the top of your head. But I digress.
Yeah. Only Wonder Woman would have a uterus strong enough to take Superman's seed.
Yeah, which apparently, by the way, DC Comics got tired of hearing that enough that to the fact that they got Lois pregnant in Convergence. And then, a long story I'm not even going to bother trying to explain, they retconned it all together into one complete Superman. Lois brought Superman's child to term with help from Batman because there were complications, probably because it's half alien. And she's perfectly fine. You know, I'm sure there was a joke made somewhere, like the kid kicks him his way out of the womb or something. But
she goes sunbathing one day and just like that little leg just pops right out.
You know.
You're like an alien scene. Ah!
Well, there's a comic book series called Savage Dragon, which actually deals in a very like realistic but still hysterical way of having superpowered children. In the fact that the Savage Dragon's kids all have like insane superpowers, and they're like mama, and they go and they grab the mom's shirt like a baby would or whatever, and just rips the shirt right from the mother's chest just because of the strength. And the mom wears a power inhibitor that allows her. She's got like a kind of a protective force field around her, so that way the babies don't, you know, when they're like breastfeeding, they're not like ripping her tits off.
Yeah.
Because of the fact that they are as insanely powerful as their father. Back to John Constantine. John has a great line Zed has a great line to John, and his response is fantastic. It says, "You always want to see the worst in people." And John looks at her in anger and says, "I always see the truth."
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and John does a lot of back talking in this episode because the whole culmination of the storyline is that John is manipulating his friend. You know, his friend got him into this problem. John manipulates him and says what he needs to say in order for Gary to kind of go along and you know, break into a museum to get a kusa knife and do all the things that he needs to do in order to contain this demon. And then at the end, Gary has to come to terms with him being the human sacrifice.
Yeah, that's John's big douchebag moment of the episode is that Zed finds out that he is not necessarily forcing Gary to be the sacrifice, but Gary's trying to do it to redeem himself in the only way he can for being a junkie his whole life and the mistakes that he made. Leading up to this, by the way, I love the fact that John has the security guard doing the ballet.
The hypnotic suggestion that as long as the music, aka the alarm, is going off, the security guard will dance.
Yes, that is
And so John
fantastic.
says, "Express yourself," and he just starts dancing funky.
Funky Town.
Oh man, yeah. John is just, and I have to think, aren't there security cameras?
He probably took care of that.
It probably did, yeah.
Yeah.
If you break it in, you probably do that, but
Yeah.
yeah, that
Speaking
was
of,
hilarious.
by the way, going back to my previous thing about how there's certain characters I wish appeared on Constantine, Zatanna never appears on the show. And it's a
No.
character I hope would appear, hopefully, maybe on Flash or Supergirl. Supergirl would be great, but we don't need to always keep forcing the female characters on Supergirl. But the Flash would make a really good show because the Flash is a meta, and he deals in meta and supernatural stuff more than Arrow does. If you're a big fan of Zatanna, who's connected to John Constantine in ways that we can explain in another episode, there's a couple great episodes of Smallville where Zatanna showed up on, and she looked amazing.
Always looks
The
amazing.
fishnets and the
Yes.
corset and everything.
The
And
fishnets and the tuxedo jacket. I mean,
oh,
please.
just swooned my
I'd do
beating
her.
heart. And she helps good old Clark Kent before he's Superman out on a couple of missions, which are a lot of fun because he's not a magic is one of the things he can't deal with being, you know, who
Yeah.
he is with superpowers. But no Zatanna on Constantine.
Nope. But we didn't mention his John Constantine's psychedelic experience in this episode. Constantine, instead of as in the comic book, he sees Papa Midnight in order to help him deal with this demonic situation. He goes to see his friend Momno, and he basically gives him
That's the shaman that I've been
a
mentioning.
hallucinogen called. Yeah, he's a shaman. He's a shaman.
He's the shaman I
But he
mentioned
gives him
earlier,
a
yeah.
hallucinogen they call the mist. I don't know what this is, but it's basically like an instant you're out of your head
Correct.
type of hallucinogen. Kind of like DMT, I would
Mm-hmm.
think. But he says that this hallucinogen lasts forever if you don't take the antidote, basically. And they have a shared vision, and you know, there's a popping out of an eyeball, and like, yeah, a lot of gross stuff in this episode, a lot of gross stuff. But the way that they did the psychedelic experience, I enjoyed. Balls of fire, celestial images, and whereas in the comic book, the way John finds out about the story of this hunger demon is that John actually travels to Sudan and talks to the shaman that actually performed this ritual, and probably due to storyline and time and locations and all that, you couldn't do it in a show like this. But the hallucinogen experience gave you that backstory in a kind of a logical way, where the shaman was giving him a sight, what he saw with his own eyes or with his own vision, and then he gives the John the antidote, and he's like, poof, back sober. A very short-lived but powerful experience that didn't waste time with the timeline of the plot.
I put down in my notes when we got to when I was watching the Shaman trip John out that I wish I had some legalized weed with me now, because we have legal weed here in Massachusetts, and the commercials have already started that if you want to become a cannabis distributor, there are weekly classes that you can take in order to get your cannabis license.
Excellent.
Yes.
Sign of the times, man. Sign of the times.
Absolutely.
Prohibition will be over soon. I'm just hoping.
They use that weird-looking knife from the museum to trap the demon, which is
That's the
Kusa
knife.
The Kusa knife. Also, the lots of popcorn. I was eating popcorn at the time that this episode was happening.
Yeah, lots of popcorn on the floor of the theater there. I think that's Victim Shown number 6.
By the way,
I'm sure there's victims in between that. But
this episode, what city does this episode take place in?
Feast of Friends.
Yeah.
What was your question?
What city? What country are we in this episode?
Oh, you're in Atlanta.
Okay, so we're in Atlanta, and John, of course, is being from Britain. Did you know that in Britain they don't put butter on their popcorn?
In Atlanta?
No, in Britain.
Oh, I did not know that.
Yeah, I had an interview with John with Oliver Harper. He's a very very good retrospective history film history reviewer on YouTube yesterday, and we were talking about popcorn at the movies, and because we both like the movie experience, and he's like, oh, here in the that's an American thing, Chris, that they put butter on the popcorn. In Britain we put sweetened salt on our popcorn and not butter. We don't like butter on our popcorn. We're not very used to it, as you Americans are.
That would be more like a kettle corn type of flavor.
That's exactly it. They kettle corn comes from Britain.
Yeah. Cool.
Yeah. So Gary takes the plunge and allows the demon to come inside him, and John then locks him up. Probably the leading towards the most depressing ending to an episode of Constantine we've come across, or if any of the episodes. Just because Gary is John's mate no matter what, and John points that out to him. Despite all his flaws and his mistakes, he's still his mate, and he would die for Gary just as he would die for, you know, Chaz or probably Zed is growing on him, so he would probably die for her as well. And John doesn't have a lot of friends just because of the way he is. But I thought it was very nice at the end that Manny shows up for Gary's salvation to bring him to heaven.
Yeah. I mean,
as the hymn music plays,
we've already seen Manny be able to just take the soul out of the body, and so he's kind of acting as like an angel of death. And so Manny shows up there at the end with Gary just kind of writhing in pain and agony, John holding his hand. Like, it's heartbreaking to see. But I think from that illustration, it's like the sacrifice that he willingly gave in order to save humanity from this demon will grant him heaven passage.
Yeah, and I love the music that's being played, too.
Oh, it's very sad. And this whole episode has a lot of character building, because, like, John gets bitched out by Zed for manipulating Gary, and
which is his
then
douchebag
John
moment.
Shoots it back at her with, like, well, this is what happens to people that come close to me. You know, if you don't like it, you can leave, type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And she sticks around, and Gary is suffering, and in the comic, he's actually locked up in basically like a prison in Papa Midnight's building. And ends up getting bricked into the cell after he passes. In this one, it's John's right there with him, holding his hand. And in the comic, he's there, but he's outside the cell, and he drinks himself into a goddamn stupor in order to deal with the pain of having to watch Gary Lester deteriorate to death. You know, this pathetic Gary Lester character that's in the comic. They gave him a much more redeeming ending in this one.
This is not the last time we see Gary. He does show up in two other episodes, but I'm not going to reveal what those are yet, and what happens with Gary continuing forward in the episodes of Constantine. But I was when Manny finally showed up, I wasn't ready for the ending for this episode, and I was just kind of like, oh wow, that was quick and to the point, and then it just kind of ends like the way it does.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But overall, I was pretty pleased with the episode, and it was a solid standalone in the overall story arc of this season of Constantine.
Yeah, whereas last episode felt a lot like a Friday the 13th the series episode. yeah, we're doing that series later, but whereas The Devil's Vinyl felt like a Friday the 13th, the series. This one really feels like this is pure Constantine because it is a story ripped from the pages, and they took that arc and they made it their own. And this, the acting was good, the effects were good. Some of the little, you know, tropes like the zero gravity traps, like a little cheesy. The spider walk, a little cheesy. But they did their homework on the occult references. They really did their homework on that, and I always appreciate that. I don't like occult references thrown in that don't matter. And this really, I think, solidifies Constantine as a show that would have kept me watching if I was watching this live.
The Collider.com talks about how Constantine is getting stronger by the week when this episode aired back on November 14th, 2014. Is that when we said this episode aired?
The episode aired on November 14th, 2014.
Okay. So Collider.com says that this episode gets stronger by the week, even as the rising darkness makes things just that much harder for the title antihero. By all rights, tonight's episode, A Feast of Friends, shouldn't have worked quite as well as it did. The goofiness of dancing hypnotized security guards, the horror of possessions by third world hunger demons, and a heightened portrayal of addiction and ultimately redeeming self-sacrifice all seem to work well together in this very fluid and coherent plot line for tonight's episode, combining some of the plenty of the most gross out engrossing story elements of friendship between two old mates that cultivates in one heart-stopping ending. And that's from Collider.com when they reviewed this episode years ago. And that's something we're going to start doing at the end of every single one of these episodes. We didn't do it for the previous show that we did, Kindred the Embraced, but I only recently thought about it after listening to a couple other great podcasts that talk about television series episode by episode. The X-Files does a really good job of it, and they're really digging into the archives because there was no internet when the X-Files first started back in 1993. So they're going based on old Starlog, Entertainment Weekly, TV Guide articles that were written. And message boards, because message boards were becoming a big thing back then. And a lot of message boards were filled with very not so polite PC ranting about, like, you know, things that would piss off a lot of women, like about Scully's wardrobe and things like that. So we're going to leave a lot of those comments out of anything that we happen to bring up from the echoes of the internet for Constantine. But almost every episode we will have a little bit of, like, what was the internet saying about this episode towards, you know, when it was airing back in 2014 and 2015. And we will try our best to do it for Friday the 13th as well. Might be a little harder because as Friday the 13th came at a time where there was really just TV Guide.
Yeah. As older than a lot of, I guess, networks are covering it.
You know, yeah, yeah. And
reviewers and stuff.
And until we get to, I would love to do Hammer House of Horror. Have you ever seen that show, Mr. Zeneca?
Ooh, no, that's a good one.
I've heard of it,
but I never saw it.
Hammer House of Horror was the end of the Hammer genre in the late 70s, early 80s. Hammer came to an end. And this was their last attempt at doing something, was a television series, an anthology series that did 13 episodes, but was canceled after 13 episodes. So it is a show that we could possibly do, and that would trump Friday the 13th as being the oldest show that we cover.
Interesting.
But shows like this, Constantine, we'll do Witchblade. We mentioned, I had mentioned to Mrs. Zeneca off air. We're gonna
I think we have to get through a lot of the ones we already have planned.
Yeah. But I'm saying that we'll have like shows that were set in the modern days that we'll find articles written about them a little easier than a show like Friday the 13th was, which came out at a time where there wasn't anything other than like Starlog and Friday the 13th. I mean, TV Guide. But if you want to follow us, you can go do so on our Facebook page at The Dead TV Podcast. And we each have individual Twitters at ChrisDSAV, which links you to all of the shows on the Radio Horror Network. And Mr. Zeneca has one.
Mine is at Elegantly Kinky. And you can find me on my website at elegantlykinky.com.
And you can download this episode on their website, www.radiohorror.com, or on iTunes or on Google Play. And also, don't forget, we have a Patreon if you'd like to help donate to the Dead TV Podcast, or if you are a sponsor of a small business, a local business. One episode of the Dead TV Podcast will remain on iTunes and on the internet forever, for unlimited downloads, for whoever downloads it. So your business will get downloaded hundreds of times by many different people. So on one episode of the Dead TV podcast that you sponsor, it can be downloaded by multiple people, and multiple people will hear your website's information. So consider that if you're a business and you want to help support us. We'd like to thank Jess O'Lantern for providing us with her theme music. Thank you, Mr. Zeneca, for joining me once again.
Thank you, Dr. Chris.
And everyone have a good night, and see you in 2 weeks.